Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Prevail, c'est de Genève programme pour politique.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organisé, dinero sucio.
Globale corruption. Ta brutte la démocratie.
Et ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión,
Gregorio.
Welcome to fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. This is not the Daily Beans. I am not AG. For those of you tuning in expecting to hear Allison, my apologies. I do have good news for you. This is a great show. Will Seabag Montefiore is here. He is an actor and comedian based in London from Leeds. He's in a sketch comedy group called Just These Please, and he has a podcast called Legitimate Likes, where he and his friends sort of argue about whether or not something that's popular is worth the hype. And basically, it's, as he puts it, it's just a bunch of people arguing. I wanted to have him on because I'm a big fan of his TikTok videos, which are satirical and wonderful, and totally you should check those out. But, you know, the coronation is tomorrow. And I wanted to do a little update on what's going on in Britain, because it's so crazy over there. I feel like they have a new prime minister every like couple of days. I keep forgetting the name of the new guy, which is not great. So I wanted to just have him on and hear his thoughts and have him walk me through what's going on there, you know, the situation on the ground in Britain. And I wanted to talk about the coronation a little bit. And also, I wanted to talk about comedy and the state of comedy, because I feel like it's difficult now in this day and age to be a comedian or to do comedy, right? Just the rules have changed. The platforms have changed. And he talks about that a little bit, too. And then at the end of the interview, we go into Succession a little bit. So if you like that show, that's at the very, very tail end. But he has some interesting ideas, too, about acting, which I found fascinating. So stick around for that. Okay, at the top of the show, I'm going to do some hot takes. Just a couple of things in the news I just wanted to point out and discuss quickly before we move on to the body of the show. The first thing is the debt ceiling. This is obviously something people are talking about a lot these days, because it's now you're reading these think pieces in very serious magazines about what might happen if we actually default on the debt. Yeah, what would happen is the entire fucking global economy would collapse. So that's bad. And the fact that the Republicans are even entertaining this idea is madness, and just is yet another example of how these assholes are not fit to govern. Ted Cruz knows this. They all know this. Kevin McCarthy is so dumb, he might not. But for the most part, they know what they're doing. They think that, as is usually the case, the Democrats will cave because they'll be like, we can't have that happen. Let's give them something that they want. And so far, Biden has shown no indication that he's going to cave, which is good. I'd also like to point out the Constitution, Amendment 14, Section 4, quote, "The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. So the word shall, from a legal and grammatical standpoint, means must. Anything that shall happen, there's no alternative for it not to happen. So it's written in the Constitution that this must happen. If the Republicans in Congress refuse to pay, they are in violation of the law. Okay? That's it. They're violating the law. They claim to love these amendments. They love their Second Amendment. So maybe they need to, like, you know, come to Jesus on the 14th. And I hope more people start writing about this. And Biden might have to take some drastic unilateral action to shut this shit down. And I hope he does, so that they can show these people that we're playing for keeps here. We're not going to jeopardize the entire financial well-being of the United States and the fucking world so that, you know, Lindsey Graham can cut Social Security. Fuck these people. Just send them back to where they came. They're not serious people. They're not worthy of governing at all. They can't do it. All they can do is make theater and these performative bullshit rants to appear on Fox News and on the next topic I want to discuss, which is Tucker Carlson. We saw another text of his. This guy's got so much dirt on him. I think it's going to keep coming out. I think it's going to trickle out. And just to double down on what I said last week, this guy cannot run for president. There's way too much shit in his closet. There's way too much in there that we don't know. He's a super private guy. He's always been that way, despite being in the public eye for such a long time. I do not think that Tucker Carlson wants the world media poking around in his personal life. That's just what I think. So this text, he was talking about a group of Trump guys beating up who he calls an Antifa kid, but it's probably just a protester. And he said, you know, jumping a guy like that is dishonorable. Obviously, this is a quote, it's not how white men fight. Yet suddenly I found myself rooting for the mob against the man, hoping they'd hit him harder, kill him. I really wanted them to hurt the kid. I could taste it. And then he uses this as a pivot and saying, whoa, what am I doing? My brain shouldn't go there, et cetera, et cetera. Without having the reflection to think that, you know, he's one of the people responsible for spewing the anger into the discourse that creates those kind of feelings. He's responsible for those guys, you know, directly or indirectly, for those guys beating up that guy, right? That's what Tucker Carlson's whole job is. So that's one thing. The other thing, obviously, super racist. It's not how white men fight. What does that even mean? It's not true. I mean, you know, I don't think fighting tactics can be split along racial lines. It's just ridiculous. Just the whole thing is madness. And the fact that this guy was in a position of power for that long is, let's just say we're really grateful that he's out. I don't know what he's going to do next. I'm sure he'll turn up on some stupid platform one of these days, depending on what his contract looks like at Fox. But good God, what a horrible human, horrible, horrible person. We're so lucky to be rid of this man. Next topic. Speaking of bad people, Paul Stanley, lead singer of Kiss, the most overrated, not even the most overrated band. I think possibly the most overrated anything of all time ever. I think that Will Seabag Montefiore should have a whole Kiss segment on Legitimate Likes, his podcast. I have never understood Kiss at all. Like, they don't have any songs that are good. They've just got that, I want to rock and roll all night and party every day. I mean, these guys are like way older than me. Do they get sick of like playing that song, putting that stupid makeup on? I don't know. The whole thing is very, very weird to me. I've never understood it. It just boggles the mind. But for these guys who are basically glam rock guys, right, in their makeup and their long hair, to come out against the parents of trans kids is really rich. But, you know, I mean, how much pull does Paul Stanley really have? I mean, personally, I wouldn't even take his advice about when and how frequently to rock and roll and party, let alone something important like this. So I hope anybody that was on the fence still about Kiss is now off the fence about Kiss and we can retire talking about them forever. Just they're lucky they made the money they did. Let's just leave it at that. Goodbye. Finally, last topic, the Supreme Court. I wrote about this on my Substack, which is called Prevail, on Tuesday in a piece called Robes Gallery. There is so much graft going on right now on the Supreme Court with these justices, particularly the conservative justices, but, you know, probably some of the not conservative ones, too, take some free trips and stuff like that. Now, it says the judges Both of the Supreme and Inferior Courts shall hold their offices during good behavior. So that's in the Constitution. That's in Article 3 of the Constitution. Okay. Now, a lot of people argue about this whole lifetime appointments thing, but Alexander Hamilton, when he was talking about it in Federalist 78, it's really more about the idea of good behavior and putting that in the Constitution. That was more important to the founders, at least to Hamilton, than anything about term limits. He says, the standard of good behavior for the continuance in office of the judicial magistracy is certainly one of the most valuable of the modern improvements in the practice of government. In a monarchy, it is an excellent barrier to the despotism of the prince. In a republic, it is a no less excellent barrier to the encroachments and oppressions of the representative body, and it is the best expedient which can be devised in any government to secure a steady, upright, and impartial administration of the laws. So, if you remember, the founders declared independence from Britain because the king was being a tyrannical dick. So the last thing they wanted was a Supreme Court dominated by George III's. Now, fast forward 235 years, and that's pretty much what we have. Of the 9 Supreme Court justices, at least 5 carry themselves like potentates, hiding their venality beneath medieval robes, insisting that their shady as fuck activities are on the up and up, demanding less scrutiny and more respect from the hoi polloi, and exacting tribute in apparent exchange for concessions on the bench. So let's take a quick survey. Clarence Thomas, most egregious offender, ProPublica was reported extensively on the freeloading judge rinsing the billionaire Harlan Crow, who has financed Thomas's vacations, travel, entertainment, meals, and mother's house? Jeez. Now, let's accept for the sake of argument the assertion that these two guys are actually friends in real life. Given Crow's long history of right-wing political activism, his generosity looks like nothing more than textbook graft. And whether this is technically illegal, as Mark Paletta, one of the 2 other dudes immortalized in that oil painting with Thomas and Crow and Leonard Leo, argues in the National Review, it misses the point. Seriously, though, if we found out tomorrow that Thomas carried Crow's Amex black card in his wallet and used it to pay for everything from groceries to gas to dry cleaning his judicial robe, would anybody be remotely surprised? Next up, Neil Gorsuch. This pompous blowhard had a piece of real estate on the market for almost 2 years. No sooner did his confirmation pass the Senate than it sold to the CEO of a ginormous law firm with a robust practice before the high court, according to Politico's Heidi Prisbola. Gorsuch pocketed between a quarter and half a mil on the transaction, which took place just 9 days after he took the robe. Now, this may be a coincidence. The chief executive in question is a guy named Brian Duffy of Greenberg Traurig. He's never met Gorsuch. He primarily donates to Democrats. The fact that he was going to be a Supreme Court justice was absolutely irrelevant to the purchase of that property, the high-powered attorney told Politico. Then he added, it's a wonderful piece of property and we're so glad we bought it. I assume he meant the acres of land and not Gorsuch. John Roberts. As far as we know, the Chief Justice doesn't participate directly in pay-for-play. But Business Insider reported that his wife, Jane Roberts, earned over $10 million in commissions from elite law firms related to her job as a legal recruiter. Now, I don't like when pundits get on their high horse about spouses of high-powered people. You know, we're all individuals. What our husband or wife does for a living really shouldn't come into question. I didn't like it when Hillary Clinton was criticized for stuff Bill did. It drove me nuts. It's the same kind of thing here. And also, Jane Roberts gave up her legal career when her husband became Chief Justice, in part to avoid the appearance of conflict of interest, which, you know, is noble. That's what you're supposed to do. Even so, if you're on the Supreme Court and your wife's job involves working closely with prominent attorneys who may have business before the court, as the kids say, it's a little sus. Also, call me crazy, but I believe that the spouses of SCOTUS judges should not be involved, even tangentially, in plots to overthrow the government. But, you know, that's just me. Amy Coney Barrett reportedly scored a $2 million advance on her book deal, which is approximately $2 million more than any book deal I've ever been involved in. Now, the way publishing works, she gets to keep every kopeck, even if the book flops. This is perfectly legal. Clarence Thomas did it too back in the day, but the optics are obviously terrible. Brett Kavanaugh, Stephanie Koff, you know, LB, we wrote a 5-part series covering Boof's financial statements and everything else over 2 years ago now. Didn't add up then, doesn't add up now. And I know it's very likely that the cash for the down payment on his Chevy Chase home and his credit card debts was furnished by his wealthy father, a retired lobbyist, but Kavanaugh never actually said so. Either he didn't want it on the record that he's a Nepo baby, or he didn't want to lie under oath about the true source of the money. We still don't know. And again, it may be legal for us not to know, but who cares? We really should know where all the money's coming from. Sam Alito. All right, fine. There's not been an expose in the press on Sam Alito financial hijinks, so maybe this little misogynistic jerk doesn't live high on the hog like his buddy Clarence Thomas. Maybe he prefers to spend his leisure time complaining about the public not respecting him, concocting tinfoil hat theories about the identity of the SCOTUS leaker, and researching obsolete British witchcraft laws he can work into future decisions stripping women of their rights. I don't know. We'll see. Scalia, by the way, is the guy that, like, invented this or popularized it or was like, hey, dudes, we can just do whatever we want. So they're all kind of copying Scalia. One of the people copying Scalia was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She, you know, was always leading the pack in special interest funded travel. So we have to say that so we don't appear partisan. In theory, Supreme Court justices are selected and confirmed because of their superior judgment. That's literally the job, right? Judgment. They're judges. Unfortunately, and unsurprisingly, lousy ethical judgment has translated to lousy judgment on the bench. Scalia gave us DC v. Heller and is therefore directly responsible for the explosion of gun violence since 2008. Roberts gave us Citizens United, opening the floodgates of dark money in politics. And he also seems like he's on a mission to, like, eradicate voting rights. Alito, of course, gave us Dobbs, which will lead directly to more women suffering and dying during pregnancy and childbirth. These are garbage decisions that have led the country down the slippery slope to fascism. Unless something is done about it, and soon, the three awful Trump appointees will only continue to speed that process along. We must expand the court. Anyway, if you want to read the full piece, it's up on my Substack, Prevail. If you want to subscribe to the Substack, that would be great. That funds my work here and there. All right. I talked a lot more than I usually do on my podcast up front, but there was a lot more to talk about this week. So without further ado, we will be right back with Will Seabag Montefiore. In the Napolitan community, there's nothing more special than when a member of your family gets made. That's what we call it when you're so good at your job that you can't be fired. It's a big fucking deal. Hi, I'm Nunzio Ciccarelli, president of the Bank of the Bada Bing. And for once, I ain't trying to sell you something. I'm here today to pay tribute to an individual near and dear to my heart, a wise guy who, this weekend, is going to be a made man. He comes from one of the biggest and oldest crime syndicates in Europe. They've done extortion, market manipulation, money laundering, human trafficking, slave labor, targeted assassination, and straight-up theft on a gigantic fucking scale. No one runs the jewels like these people. And even better, they got the whole world believing they're on the up and up. And yeah. There's been some serious competition lately from the Russians, but you know what? Ivan can buy all the football teams he wants. Don't change the fact that our boy's mug is on the fucking money. You know who I'm talking about. So give it up for my boy Charlie, the fucking king. True, he's a bit old for the job and a little unorthodox. You're supposed to take your gumar out on Friday night, not marry her and make her queen. But even so, the Bank of the Bada Bing sends its sincerest congratulations on his special day. From the Ciccarelli family to the House of Saxe, Goldberg, and Gotha. Mazel tov. Long live the king. I hope this doesn't fuck up the thing we got going on in Jersey. Also, tell your brother to give me a call about the Epstein thing. And now, back to the show. Will Seabag Montefiore, welcome to Prevail Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. It's nice to talk to you, in, I'd say in person, but via the internet.
It's as close to in person as a lot of things get, I think, these days. Thank you for coming on. I'm a fan of your comedy. You have I spent the morning going through your TikTok channel, which I've done before, and it's just very funny stuff.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, for people unfamiliar, I think the first thing that I saw that caught my attention on the Twitter was you did a little TikTok about filling out your taxes and. It's called like an actor fills out taxes and trying to figure out like what you can write off and stuff like that. It was just very funny, I thought. And then you do these political kind of, jokey things where you're fake interviewing someone or you're interviewing yourself, in kind of a way. They're all very funny. So that prompted me to be like, he's really funny and smart and he's savvy about British politics. And
I'm very confused now about the state of British politics. Rather than have on, you know, someone who's a politician or a journalist, I'm going to have him on, then we can at least, we can laugh about it. I think it would be more fun, you know?
Okay, yeah, I would caveat everything with, I probably know enough about British politics to make those minute and a half videos. And then as soon as I make them, the facts go out of my head.
Okay, look, that's fine.
We're here. We'll work it. We'll work through it.
We're going to work through it. I think that the things that I'm going to ask are remedial enough that you'll be able to.
yeah, great, great.
You'll be able to keep them. You're also, before we turn the camera on, you were telling me about your podcast, which is called Legitimate Likes. So tell everybody about that, because that sounds like really fun.
Well, it is fun, but it's also another channel where there's no expertise and just idiots sort of talking about stuff. But it's a podcast where we take a look at some of humanity's most popular things, like from George Clooney to vegetarianism, and decide whether they're worthy of the hype. They're likes, but are they legitimate likes? We've had some good guests. I'd recommend going and having a listen. Before you listen to the rest of this podcast, just turn it off and go on. No, don't do that. Don't, please.
Well, certainly you can pause and then go follow, you know, or hit the little plus sign, you know.
Yeah,
I think we can have that, you know, that will work.
Yeah, you can do both.
What was the verdict on George Clooney, or is it a spoiler to ask?
I think it is a spoiler, but this might be a spoiler as well, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't really mean anything. We don't get to get rid of George Clooney, but I think we said that he wasn't a legitimate like. But often the decisions are made just to spite each other. As you know, all good podcasts are, it's a couple of boys and one girl just arguing for an hour. So enjoy it.
That's fine. I don't know how much arguing we're going to do here. I don't know. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. I don't know. we'll see how it goes.
We'll make the special relationship less special.
The other TikTok video that you did is you did a rap song to the Succession theme coming into the, you know, to the new season, which I thought was fantastic.
Thanks. This is a real... ego boost. This is great. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, well, you know, people should get... Look, I want to talk later in the second half of the podcast about comedy in general, because I think that, you know, we need to laugh now more than ever before. And yet it is harder to find things to laugh about, I think, in some ways. Like, you know...
Yeah, I've definitely found that doing more satire stuff, because I've been doing the satirical videos for maybe a year and a half, 2 years. And there are just a lot of stories that come to you and I find it very hard. Some of them I just don't know how to make funny because they're so bleak.
Yeah, it is a bleak moment, but we'll talk about that on the second half of the podcast. Have you found that when people sit down and talk about comedy and try to analyze it, it's like the least funny thing that there is?
100%. It's like the biggest turnoff, but it's also exactly all I want to do all the time. So it's a perfect recipe for a podcast that I would listen to.
Good. Well, okay. Yeah. That's it. That's where we're at. So, okay, before we get started, talk a little bit about yourself and how you got into this, you know, the satirical stuff. You're an actor, you do these comic things, but tell everybody a little bit about who you are.
My name is Will. I was born in, no, I won't go that far back. I grew up in Leeds in the north of England. My dad's a doctor, my mum's a nurse. And moved to London to do acting, and had been like various jobs working in bars to, you know, to actually have money to do it. It's becoming a more and more a prohibitively expensive thing to do unless you have a wealthy background and a support system. So I've been lucky enough to be able to continue doing it. I've been in London acting and working for about 10 years, done little TV jobs, been murdered in a couple of things, advertised Onken yogurt. And then just moved into comedy because it was the thing that I enjoyed creating most on my own when there were no acting jobs. When I first got into it, I was like, I'm going to be a serious actor. I will be the next James Bond. And there's secretly a part of me that still believes that. But it might not happen. But so I started making stuff just because that was what I liked creating. And then it gained a bit of traction online. And the reason I started doing it online was because of a comedian called Munya Chihuahua, who's an English comedian who I think is the king of online satire. He's amazing. And he spoke on a podcast called Hip Hop Saved My Life about how to do social media stuff. So I'd recommend listening to that. So that's where we're at now. I meet people like you because I make dumb videos on the internet.
They're very funny. They're very funny and they're very smart. They're not dumb. I know you say that they're dumb. I don't think they're dumb. The the people you're satirizing absolutely are dumb, but I think the videos themselves are not. So
yeah,
okay,
we're meeting the first cultural difference of I was recently working in America, and oh, we love to self-deprecate. English people we love to apologize about everything apart from our colonial past. It's amazing.
Okay, so you want to be the next James Bond, but who's your go-to Bond? Are you a Connery guy, or do you have, you know, is that too old school for you?
I'm a Daniel Craig guy, you know. So because I'm 31, so that was I remember watching Pierce Brosnan and thinking it was all cool and stuff, and then I really liked I just loved Casino Royale. I thought it was an amazing film. I loved the like different elements of the character that it brought in. Generally, I'm not a huge Bond fan. I think it's fine. I think it's all the like culture war stuff that erupts around it really annoys me. But they're pretty good films. But Daniel Craig is my Bond. But maybe because he has blonde hair and I have blonde hair.
Okay. I'm an OG. I love the Connery Bond, and you know, never will be surpassed or equaled. And
oh wow,
yeah.
I think what is it you like about it?
A number of different things. Mostly, I think, because I watched it when I was a kid, and it gives me a sense of you know, security, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
Knowing that this guy is there. Also, I like that they don't do like crazy things. Like once he's jumping out of airplanes without a parachute, I'm out. You know, it's just like, you know, there's a scene, you know, in Goldfinger when he's locked in the vault at the end with Oddjob, you're actually feel genuine terror because the guy's so much bigger and you're like, oh my God, he's going to get his ass kicked, like physically beaten. And you can feel it being scary. That kind of thing just isn't, they can't do it that way anymore. And I wish that, you know, kind of they would. And
they've got to keep topping it.
Yeah.
So that's why I loved that scene in Casino Royale. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Big spoiler alerts, everybody. But he drinks some poison, realizes he's been poisoned, and has to go to his, like, makes himself sick with salt and has to go to his car to try and defib himself. I think that's like real panic and quite like, there's no jumping out of planes. That's just poison.
Yeah.
That was
a good scene. And that is a good movie. You know, I prefer Daniel Craig not as Bond, weirdly, but I like him in everything else somehow.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I think it is. Nostalgia does a lot of heavy lifting, doesn't it? Because he was just the first time I properly was like, whoa, this is a great franchise.
Yeah.
Whereas Pierce Brosnan, I was like, whoa, Invisible Car.
Well put. Okay, so I wanted to have you on principally to talk about what's going on in Britain so that I could understand.
Great.
Because I do this periodically. Arthur Snell, who is a former British diplomat, came on during the brief Liz Truss era.
No, there's no trust involved in her.
And kind of walked me through what was happening with that and with Kwasi Kwarteng. So I have some idea of that. But now we have a new guy, Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I want you to walk me through who the players are, what your impression of them is, what functions they serve. Should we be worried about them as A, Americans, and B, people that don't like fascists? It seems like no on that count. They're all bankers, I think, this crew. And so let's start with that. Like, tell me, what's your impression of the new prime minister? He's only been there for a short time.
Yeah. So to walk it back slightly, Liz Truss recently just spoke to to a right-wing think tank in the US. I don't know if you saw this, that she spoke to the Heritage Fund.
Fun.
Basically blamed, I'd never heard of them before, but they don't seem like great people. But she spoke to them and basically said that the reason for her collapse and you know why everything fell apart was because of this like left-wing woke resistance, the like new elite that are holding things back. So probably a good caveat to say that I'm one of those guys, baby. it wasn't Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng's terrible economic policy that tanked the pound. It was me for eating too much tofu. Rishi took over because he was sort of him. I think he and Liz Truss ran against each other and she won. And then she was in there for 44 days. Everything went wrong. And I think that was sort of a cursed chalice, a poison chalice, both cursed and poisoned anyway. I don't think there was an easy way out of the situation that Boris Johnson had got us into and the 12 years of Conservative Party rule had got us into. You might be hearing a hint of bias in my descriptions here. Rishi took over and his personal net worth is more than the personal net worth of King Charles. So him and his wife are worth 400 million. No, sorry, around 600 million. And King Charles's personal wealth is around 400 million. Obviously, he has about 12 billion in assets, royal assets. But the personal wealth, the guy's richer than the king. And under his rule, I think generally we're sort of behind you. We like scapegoating America, being like, look what those crazy idiots are doing. But we're sort of slowly following in this weird tribute act where we're just moving gradually to the right. And you can see that in the current government and also in the opposition, I think, in the Labour Party. Yeah. So that's I think, where we're at. And the major players, we've got Rishi Sunak, who's the Prime Minister. Suella Braverman, who is currently spending her time demonizing immigrants and asylum seekers. And the great country of the UK have spent £140 million on a scheme to deport asylum seekers and people coming here illegally to Rwanda. And that's been in action for about a year and a bit. And we've sent zero people there. And the European Human Rights Committee were like, I don't think this is okay. But Suella thinks it's good.
Isn't there like a labor shortage there, though? I mean, isn't it probably, you know, from purely economic standpoint, probably good to have people come into the country to do the jobs that other people don't want to do?
Oh, no, they're stealing jobs. Didn't you know, Greg? They come and steal jobs. Yeah, yeah. Okay. They don't apply for jobs and do them. They steal them from people who would definitely be doing them otherwise, you know?
Okay. Yeah. This is the same, you know, the same shit that the Republicans here pull. You know, the immigrants are coming, they're going to take your job, they're going to do this, they're going to do that, without you know, factoring in what they mean to a functional economy.
Yeah, and it's also the enemy of the, like, this sort of dog whistling stuff, that the actual enemy, I think, are people like Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, who are trying to enact economic policy that benefits the rich and doesn't benefit all the people at the bottom who need help. Like, there's a huge rise in people using food banks. A load of different unions are on strike at the moment, and it's really bleak. And the people who get demonized are the people who need the help the most. And I don't like that. Good thing you invited a comedian on, right? This has been fun.
Now, see, this is good. See, you told me I don't know anything. You know everything. Yeah. And I just feel also that they're, you know, in addition to being just, you know, in it for money, just completely tone deaf. Like, I feel like not only do they not understand or sympathize or empathize with people who need help, I don't think they get it at all. I think that it's just, you know, I think they believe their bullshit. Do you get that sense, or do you think they're just...
Definitely. I think, I just burping through my answer there.
You can, that's fine, because I can edit that out.
No, leave it in. Leave it in. It's more honest.
Okay.
I drank my squash too quickly. Oh, we should talk about squash, because I don't think you guys have squash in the UK, but that's, we can put a pin in that, in America, sorry.
Squash, like, what is squash? What is that?
So...
It's not like the plant, not the thing you eat.
No, it's not.
I saw you drinking it. So
yeah. No, I don't blend up pumpkins and then.
Okay.
No, it's like I've never had to describe squash. It's sort of a syrupy, like undiluted syrupy drink. You know, like when you get Coca-Cola, they've mixed syrup and carbonated water.
Yeah.
Imagine just the syrup of that. You buy that and then you put it in a glass. You top it up with water. Everybody has squash. In the UK, it's a real thing, and it doesn't seem to be the same in the US.
I'm 85% convinced you're putting me on right now, and you were just drinking water, but it's okay.
No, I can go get a bottle of squash, Greg. I'll take a picture of it.
I'm kidding.
Sorry, where were we?
I said I think these guys believe the bullshit. I feel like that. I think when Liz Truss says it's not me, it's not my policies, it's this, that, and the other, I think she genuinely believes that her stupid bullshit policies are totally great.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, there's a guy called Owen Jones. I don't know if you're familiar with Owen Jones,
No.
Who is a journalist and political commentator, who I think he's one of the best in the UK at articulating what's going on at the moment. And he was, I'm going to butcher his words, but he was talking about, like, since Margaret Thatcher in the 80s, she came in, started privatizing everything, and it was doing sort of like, I think it's similar to Reaganomics.
Yeah,
I think that would be the equivalent. And I think the political establishment, and I say that being like, you know, I think that phrase has been co-opted by the right a lot, but there is a political establishment in this country where all of these boys went to school with each other.
Yeah.
And they climb up the ranks and they go through uni and there's university and college and there's all these, like, so many of them went to Cambridge and Oxford and went and did and went to Eton, which are the earlier schools and stuff. And I do think for a lot of them, it's a bit of a game and it's a bit of fun. And they're like, it's this political power struggle. And I think there is a big gap between, you know, what it's really like to live in the country and the decisions, how they're being affected. So I think they do believe their own bullshit and they just believe, I don't, it's really, really hard to work out what they think actually, because I think there is a big separation.
It's strange because now you have a situation where Brexit happened. It's been a couple of years now since that happened. It's an unmitigated disaster. I think everyone realizes that it's such a disaster that on the podcast, that interview that I did a couple of weeks ago with Max Fawcett, you know, we were talking about the province of Alberta possibly seceding. And he's like, nobody's doing that because of Brexit. All you have to say is, look what happened over there. Do you want that to happen here? And people won't vote for it. Yeah. So it's almost an object lesson in horror. And yet there hasn't been a Labour prime minister. Like, it's the same. It's like you have to find people that voted for it and believe in it still to run the country. That's what it seems like from my vantage point. Like, I don't understand. Right. Why these fuckers are still in power. They fucked up so badly. Why? Like, they're not going to be able to fix it. The people that, right? The people that started this and pushed it through. I mean, how can they fix it?
Well, there was no, they didn't care. The people who campaigned strongly for it, as soon as it happened, none of them were in charge. None of them were in power. Yeah. And they didn't have to, they were like, and it was all lies. This is the hard thing about it. And yeah, it does seem like, it's still a sticking point for people that we still come back to, but we're now in a position where it's very, very difficult for us to go back to the EU, because I think that would mean adopting a new currency, like adopting the euro and stuff. And so it's done. We're gone. And it was a disaster. Yeah. It is a disaster. Continues to be one. Could you repeat the question again? Because I got distracted.
I think that was it. I mean, the if you go look at the list of prime ministers, I'm like, there hasn't been a Labour prime minister in quite some time, and it's all conservatives. Theresa May at least seemed like she was vaguely honest and capable. And then because the Brexit thing, she had to leave. And then it's just been a clown car since then. Yeah, Boris Johnson is you know, I don't even know what to say about him at this point. Well, I mean,
he's just the UK's Trump, as far as I'm concerned. Like, he's got a history of bigotry. He's got silly hair. And he doesn't seem to care about the most vulnerable in society, and like has all these pull quotes. He's all he has this like air of like bumbling idiot, but actually I think it's much more dark than that. But yeah, it's a complicated one because Labour, I think the Leave campaign was so well funded, and I don't understand sort of the dark forces at work as to why it was so well funded. And the Remain campaign just didn't have a strong leader. And I think that's partially because the media leans more to the right. And I think it's partially because at the time, Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party. And I joined the Labour Party for Corbyn. I'd never joined a political party before, but I was really excited about him. I think he's always had a history of, you know, not really liking large blocks of power. And so for socialist reasons, was never too cool about Europe, which put him in a compromised position when it came to leading a campaign to stay in the EU. And I think it just, there was no figurehead and no real leader. And so it became, because I could understand the left-wing arguments to leave, but I was like, on this rhetoric, it's all being done on bigotry. And it also was done on, like, people were very disenfranchised and times were really tough for people. So then they were given this option, do you want to remain or do you want to leave? And the active choice in that is to leave, is to say things aren't good. So it was, I have a load of problems with how it happened, but it happened. And yeah, we're still feeling the fallout of it. And it is interesting. Yeah, we haven't really had, I don't know enough about whether we've had any Remainers who've been in positions of power. I think Keir Starmer was Remain, I think, who's the leader of the opposition at the moment.
He seems to be the leader of the opposite, but he also seems to be somebody that's largely kind of invisible on from a charisma standpoint. That seems to be the book on him. He's an honest guy, and all the, you know, on paper his resume looks good, but he's not terribly an inspirational figure. And I don't think I could pick him out of a police lineup. And his name sounds like an alt-right, you know, Reddit channel. It's like very similar to Daily Stormer. I don't know. It's so is there somebody waiting in the wings here? Like, no,
I don't know, man. I'm pretty worried about the whole thing. I don't know what we do, because Keir is, I think what Keir Starmer, and I, to say that he's forgettable, I literally walked past him in the street and my partner, I was talking to my partner and she went quiet. And I was like, why has she gone quiet? She was mid-sentence. And she was like, Will, we just walked past Keir Starmer. And I was like, oh, that guy. And I'm the one who does the satire. Like, it's terrible. This is what I'm saying. This is not, I should not be on this platform. But is there someone waiting in the wings is a really difficult question, because Keir Starmer is moving the party to the further to the right, I think. And they were left of center, but I don't think they're a party that, they're called Labour, and I don't see them supporting the workers very well anymore.
Yeah.
And it seems that his tactic is to appeal to people who are becoming disenfranchised with the Conservatives, and everything's moving to the middle. And I have no understanding of history, apart from the history of Leeds United in the early 90s. But I think that tends to be what happens when fascist groups and fringe groups start getting more popular, because everything's moving to the center, so people start looking to the extremes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's true.
It makes sense. Now, what do you think of this idea? Like, why can't somebody like Hugh Grant just be prime minister? Like, why can't he run? I mean, he played prime minister in Love Actually. And I think, you know, he's his politics are in the right place from what I could tell, based entirely on his Twitter feed. You know, because in America, we do that. We'll run a celebrity. We'll run a retired football player if we think that it will help, you know, get into office. And my goodness, it almost did. Is there like some unwritten rule that cannot happen there, or
I think for a while there definitely was, and we looked over the pond and thought, ha ha, you've got Trump, but I think we're like 5 years behind you. But this is, I'm stealing that quote from Ian Hislop, who's the editor of Private Eye magazine, which is, I think, the best investigative journalism in the UK. He spoke to John Stewart recently on The Problem with John Stewart, and he said that we're about 5 years behind you guys. And so we're about 5 years behind you guys. And basically the celebrity being, I think Boris Johnson did this, of appearing like a fun character.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay. And then I think the cultural low point of probably the 21st century in the UK was when Matt Hancock, the ex health secretary, went on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I don't know if you know the show.
No.
So it's a reality TV show where they get a load of celebrities, put them in the jungle in Australia. They have to do loads of tasks like eating bugs and climbing through snake infested stuff. And they live in a little camp together, and it's just trash TV, whatever. Matt Hancock went on it and was paid, I think, £300,000 to go on it whilst he was still a sitting member of parliament, and was there to sort of, he said he was there to raise awareness about dyslexia. He mentioned it once. Fine. It might have been edited out, I don't know. But it was like the line between those worlds of being a politician who's like doing a job, however you're looked at, whatever, but then going on a show to sort of humanize yourself, right? And to get, and it really worked, and it made great TV, but it was awful. So I think we're getting to that point, and I would like it to go the other way, and people like Hugh Grant. Or if you look at Eddie Izzard, do you know Eddie Izzard, the mm-hmm. comedian?
Sure.
So, who I believe uses she, her pronouns now. She is running as a Labour candidate.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Okay.
So, yeah. And I think she's brilliant. I think she's got great thoughts and is a real like surge of hope for the Labour Party. But the Labour Party are currently trying to erode trans people's rights. So that is pretty unhelpful.
Yeah, that's what a shit show. I feel like maybe you'll be prime minister, because there is, you know, comic actors that become leaders of the country. We have one.
I could do a Zelensky. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it could happen.
Great. Yeah. You heard it here first, folks. I'm giving hope to all the middle class white boys with double barreled names. We can do it too.
Okay, this is I always forget to do this. This is a good time to take a break. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Will Seabag Montefiore. Okay, we're back with Will Seabag Montefiore.
Woohoo!
For the very long break, we were talking about, you know, Brexit and the this clown car of conservative prime ministers that you've had there. You mentioned it up top. You've been in London for, what, 10 years now? Over 10 years in London, something like that? So I've heard tell of big, you know, London changing, especially post-Brexit. So what's the report on the city now? Is it true what they say about, you know, there's sometimes you go to the store, there's no food on the shelves? Like, what's going on? How has it changed in the post-Brexit years?
I think the supply chain issues that we have tend to affect... London tends to be a bit of a bubble. And there's an issue, I think, with the country that all the issues are decided in London by people who live in London. And the supply chain issues have been bad. There have been times where you can't get stuff. But it's hit, I think, rural areas more. And often the main victims of Brexit have been the people who, in my opinion, were sort of tricked into voting for it as some sort of protest vote to make their lives better. And like the people of Kent, I think, overwhelmingly voted to leave. And then Brexit went through. And then suddenly they're building a huge truck depot in the green land of Kent to be. And they were like, hold on, we don't want this. And then there are people on my side of the argument who are like, this is what you deserve. And I think there's a more nuanced answer to it. So London, it definitely is different. I think anecdotally, it feels like there's more homelessness. Statistically, there's definitely more people using food banks, as I mentioned before, and it's life is harder and more expensive for people. Not people like me who are part of the champagne socialist elite. We're fine. So, but yeah, people who are genuinely struggling, I think it is really hard. And London's a real melting pot, so it's quite difficult to be bigoted and horrible when you're surrounded by so many different people. But the people at Westminster do a good job of it. They managed to push through anyway.
What about the real estate? Are the rents like going up? Is it stable or is that going up as well? Like, what's going on with that?
That's a good question. I think it is everything is going up, I think, is the main thing. And like part of that is post-COVID. Part of that is, I think, a lot of knock-on effects from like international events. But I think the main thing is 12 to 13 years of conservative rule and austerity and pumping money out of state-funded services and stuff. So things are getting more expensive. It's harder to buy in London. Like if you were to buy like a 4-bed house, you could be paying up to £1 million in like a relatively normal area. You go up to where I'm from, Leeds, you could do that for probably like £400,000, I think, maybe less, maybe 300. I don't know. I'm not very au fait with the statistics, but it definitely is harder for people who aren't rich, basically.
Yeah. which is how these the very rich people want it to be, really. You know,
that's what it feels like. And I really don't understand it, because it doesn't, I guess it's just that if you, yeah, I don't get it.
Well, it's a, you know, they want to be oligarchs. They look at the Russian oligarchs, and on some level they want to be, you know, treated that way.
We do have a lot of empty property in London too. Like a lot of places bought up by people that's just left. So that's fun.
It's like that in New York too. Probably in Miami, I think it's like that. You know, I often wondered when I lived in New York City, like how many of these really nice apartments are just vacant at any given time. Like, nobody's there. You know, you have a bunch of people sharing some 2-bedroom and on the Lower East Side and sprawling nice place. You know, plenty of room, and maybe there's a cat there that has to be fed occasionally, and that's it. Which, you know, good for the cat, but we've been talking about Britain now this whole time. I want to get also your thoughts on what's happening in the U.S. because we're in a weird position now too with things. You might have heard, like, not that long ago, a couple years ago now, a bunch of people tried to overthrow our government. They were tourists, but they were trying to overthrow the government. And we've been sort of reeling since then. But what is your take on things over here? Because I'm curious just to hear, you know, from your vantage point, what you're seeing and what you think.
So I recently was in the States, and I was absolutely flabbergasted, and I don't use that word lightly, by the news that I watched. Because you hear a lot about Fox News and stuff, right? And especially with the cases that are happening now of all
Dominion,
I cannot believe that you turn on the TV on a channel that has news in the title and there's people just shouting their opinions at you. Like, And we are, the UK is trying to move that way. Rupert Murdoch's tried to set up Talk TV, which doesn't get great views. And GB News is also one of them, where they're trying to do this and be deliberately controversial, peddle disinformation and misinformation. I don't know the difference between the two. and if I tried to say which one is, I'll end up saying one of them. But I was staggered by the media. And I think we definitely look, I said it earlier, we definitely look at the US like we're a lot better than you. And I think that's because of a deep-seated sort of English arrogance, but also because we don't have guns. our country's way smaller. It's easier to manage a smaller place, I think. And you're quite a young country, I guess. So the whole Trump thing, I think there's been recently more fringes of people like being pro-Trump and talking about this like political elite who are like undermining him and getting into the realm of like QAnon conspiracy and stuff. But it's still quite, I think it's quite minor, and that I think they're growing, but it's quite minor. So I think we look at you like, I cannot believe that you still have guns. Like I understand why, but it's in a country that doesn't have them and has had like 4 school shootings in its entire history. If it weren't so tragic, it would be hilarious.
Yeah, no, it's well put. Why do you think we have guns? Because that's another interesting question.
Well, it's our fault as a country. and I understand the constitutional right, but I think probably it's lobbying, right? It's money, yeah, and lobbying that keeps it alive. Because I think for the most part, I don't know, I feel like you would just have regulated them earlier if they were in the UK or a European country. I don't know. Why do you think you do?
Okay. No, I was curious about your take because the shooting thing drives me crazy on multiple levels. But one of the reasons why is it makes us look so horrible on the international stage, just big picture.
Yeah.
We look like barbarian morons, and we can't fucking get our shit together with something super basic. Like you don't need to have a weapon of war. You know, it's one thing to have you have a shotgun, you live on a prairie, you have to shoot a coyote or something, but you don't need an AR-15 for that. We had them banned. There was a ban on them, and all the shooting statistics went down. Then they allowed it to lapse, and now it's back up again. There's no question about it. But
I guess your country was built like with the help of, well, with mostly England, was built on, my understanding anyway, built on freedom. And freedom, I think, means A, murdering an indigenous population and taking over, but B means you have the right to do whatever you want, right? So like, and the guns were an inherent part of that when the founding fathers made it. It was like, we need these guns to protect ourselves from international powers that will take over. Totally get it. You need the ability to become a militia. I would argue you don't need that anymore. I think you're fine.
Yeah, I think they needed the guns also because of the, you know, the native populations that we were in the process of pushing out and killing off. I think, you know, that was part of it too. And yes, you know,
a nice noble reason.
Yeah, and this whole slave thing, you know, which we also don't like to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
The dual sins of my country. But at this stage of the game, I think it's just Russia infiltrated the NRA and they, you know, they did. Torsion and Butina are in there. They're influencing policy. Every time there's a shooting, it makes Putin look better because Russia has very strict gun control laws and we don't.
Whoa.
So he can say, hey, this doesn't happen here. You know,
yeah,
look at these American jerks shooting each other like idiots.
Yeah. And I think it's important on the slavery front that the UK, I think a lot of the rhetoric that gets bandied about when issues of race come up in this country is that the UK outlawed slavery and, you know, stopped it and helped like fight against it. And that is it's a huge whitewashing of history. It's like we were so culpable and so responsible. Even when we had outlawed it in our country, we sent very small fleets to try and police it. Like we didn't care. And it was built on, our country was built on slave money as well. So I think that's another level where we scapegoat you guys and go, God, they're bad. But our racism is just hidden under layers of fake politeness. You guys just shout it louder, I think. So I don't think I think we like to think we're better than the States. And I think it's worryingly similar. We haven't had an insurrection yet, but we have had large protests for horrible things.
This is true. So, okay, so talking about insurrections and changes in government, this is a good time to talk about the monarchy, because we're recording this on the 15th of April, but I'm going to run it the day before the coronation of Charles III. And
very nice.
Yeah. He obviously did not read very much about Charles the First and the Second, who were not really terribly great, did not have great, you know, runs of things as monarchs, but maybe third time is a charm. It's going to be interesting. It's the first coronation since, what, 53, something like that. Yeah. So anybody even involved with the, you know, with the first one is either dead or super, super old. So it'll be as a bit of pomp. It'll be interesting, I think, to watch just as a, what's the word, pageantry from that angle of things. But I mean, how powerful can he ever be at this point? And if he's not, what's the point? I mean, what's your take on all of this? Maybe we should start with the Queen. What was your, because we were talking about this before we turned the camera on.
Yeah.
You know, she dies. What's it, during the Liz Truss era, the brief Liz Truss era, what was your take and what were you seeing?
Was it her fault? We don't know that it wasn't her fault.
The lettuce is dead. The Queen is dead. It's what was going on there?
The Queen passing away is a really interesting media storm. Obviously a very like human and personal tragedy for the people who knew her. But in terms of the media storm and like the response publicly, I was quite surprised with, especially in like the circles I run in, because surprise, they tend to be lefty liberal sort of beta male circles where we all hug each other and talk about our feelings. But I was very surprised how many people would speak about, like, they'd post, "Thank you for your service, Mom." And like, I think there's something inherently quite funny about sharing grief on Instagram and Twitter. I think it's a genuine thing to do. I think it's really nice and helpful for people. I've done it. Like, I think it's lovely. But I think also it's very, very funny when someone, because she's not going to see it, lads. She's not going to see it. Like, and I understand you're aligning yourself and it's a moment to all come together, but I think there are more important moments to come together. And I was so surprised. I don't know if you heard about the queue, or as the American translation would be, the line, which was the queue to see her lying in state. Did you hear about it?
Just briefly. So tell us about it.
250,000 people lined up in like a 3 or 4 mile long queue, maybe longer, all across London, that was all policed and cordoned off to go and see the Queen's body lying in state. And so many people went and lined up to see the monarch. So there is still a huge amount of, like, you know, she's a national symbol. We still have the monarchy. It means a lot to people. But I couldn't believe that people would queue for like legit 20 hours to see the Queen.
Well, the Queen a long time. I don't know.
On the other hand, she has.
It's probably like, you know, you can go next day. It's not going anywhere. I don't know. Do you think it's because of her? Do you think it's because she's the Queen, or do you think it's because of her? Because my take is that really her personally invested. So, you know, there's such a the national love seems to be more for her than for the institution.
Yeah, she was very popular, and like I think she was good. She had a good team around her, I think, who were like good at. You know, she had a good sense of humor. She seemed warm and she seemed nice. I think she reminded a lot of English people of their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And there is something about having a cultural figure around for that amount of time. And then they leave, that, you know, it's the ending of an era and stuff. But fundamentally, for the people who didn't know her, I don't understand why there's other stuff happening that I think was more important. And, a death is always sad. I think it should always be mourned, and like, I wasn't too stoked about the jokes about it, because I was like, somebody died. But also the outpouring of grief from people who didn't seem to. But then it's hard. You can't judge someone's grief. So I don't know. I think she was very, very popular. People seemed to like her. And even people who didn't really care about the monarchy were like, she was a good one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was on TV in the U.S. too. It was on TV. It was on the news stations. 24/7. I mean, for a while it was. You know, they knew it was going to happen. They rolled it all out. It was, you know, and she's not our, you know, we have not had a British monarch in quite some time in this country. So, you know, it was interesting to see how that happened. And now we have, you know, we have Charles, and it's interesting that the Queen comes in the last days of her watch. Brexit happens, which shrinks the size of the territory. So Charles sort of reminds me of the Byzantine emperors who had to, after the fall of Constantinople, who had to repair to Trebizond, you know, with this tiny little rump state and rule from there. So the lasting image I have of him was when he was sneering at his underling because the inkwell wasn't properly in the right spot on the desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is your take on him, and what is the popular temperature of him right now?
That's a really good question. I don't quite know. I think, to be honest, most people are just, most of the rhetoric around the coronation is this horrible culture war that's cropped up and been generated and stoked about Meghan Markle.
Yes.
Which is just undeniably racist.
Yeah.
Like there are news stories where you see Kate Middleton, who's William's wife, and she'll be like, oh, look how delicately Kate ate this peanut butter sandwich. And then if Meghan ate a peanut butter sandwich, they'd be like, oh, I guess she hates kids with peanut allergies and wants them all to die. Like there are, it's stark and brazen. So yeah. That's most of the conversation that is around it. Because Charles seems like, I don't think he'll ever be as popular as the Queen. Because she came, you know, she was a post-war monarch and... you know, was very good at talking to people. And so he seems fine, but he's a bit of a weirdo. But he does some good. Like, he's very pro the environment. Like, his car, I don't know if you know this, his car is run on wine and cheese, which is probably the most English thing that could exist. But they get the waste products from wine and cheese making, turn it into biofuel. And that's what powers his cars.
I feel like that's just going to be an invitation for him to one day invade France. You know, I think...
Yeah, my car's not running, guys. So I need to come in.
Yeah. I'm gonna retake Normandy.
Yeah, I don't know if he'll ever be as popular, but most of the, I don't really know how people feel about it. I think people in Scotland are like, we don't give a shit. We haven't voted for this guy. You know, there's definitely an air of like an unelected official. Why do we have an unelected head of state? But I think in terms of the people who like the monarchy, I don't know how they feel towards Charles, and I think more of it is about Harry and Meghan.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, thanks for I don't know if I'm gonna tune in or not. I mean, I'm kind of curious, but you know, I don't like monarchies, and I you know, in the movie The Naked Gun, Leslie Nielsen, which is about the Queen of England, comes to Los Angeles, and he says at the press conference, you know, as ridiculous as the idea of having a queen seems to you and me as Americans, we must be considerate and gracious hosts. And I feel like that sums up exactly my okay, it's fine to to do this if we have to. I was going to ask you, and I'm not going to because I know the answer, if you were related to Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is a historian, and the answer is distantly and therefore it's not terribly relevant.
Yeah, we follow each other on Twitter, but that's about it.
Okay. Because I looked at his page and it said that he was friends, you know, he's friends with Charles. So I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the family. And I don't know how much my talking on podcasts about how I'm not really a huge fan of the monarchy is gonna help the family reunions. But look, we'll find out. But yeah, it's a huge family, the Sebag Montefiore family. So someone with that name will be distantly related to me somehow.
Yeah. It's probably the same with me. Oliar is also not a very typical name. You know, if somebody's named that somewhere.
So I would like to say, if any fans of Simon are listening, I'm not speaking on behalf of the family, nor indeed him. But he's a great writer. So you should read his books.
Yeah, he is. I read the Jerusalem one. It's good. Okay, so now for the last part of the show here, I want to talk about comedy and the state of comedy, because I feel like, you know, it's changed. Like, my own relationship to it has changed. I mean, I try to do on my podcast and on the other things, I try to interject humor with everything. Even when I'm writing about super serious things, I try to at least throw in a couple of pop culture references to make everybody laugh and get through the horror of it all. But I've found like there's certain types of comedy that don't play anymore. Like, you know, there used to be this thing on the internet where you would pretend to be somebody else and da 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 da. And I feel like that's just, it wasn't terribly funny ever, but it's certainly not funny now when all of my brain is being taxed constantly, having to sift out, you know, what's real and what's not and what's fake news and what's disinformation. Like, I don't want some fucking quote unquote funny person to try to fool me and this and that. What's your take on it? How have you, I don't know, you know what I'm trying to get at here. I'm just trying to understand how it's evolved, I guess.
Yeah, I think to speak as a quote unquote funny person, I think it's really moved. The pandemic changed it a lot in terms of the form through which we consume stuff. It also really created a pipeline for comedians to gain following and, you know, stuff like that, because people are on their phones more. I think it's like, there's definitely an appetite for satire, and there's definitely an appetite for like, there's an appetite for silliness and surrealness, but as I mostly do satire and stuff, that's sort of where I feel most comfortable talking. I think for me anyway, when I'm making stuff, it really helps me understand something and like trying to construct a joke that makes sense and is funny and doesn't, you know, create disinformation about a subject, I think is really helpful. And a lot of the time when I will see news stories from comedians, like there's comedians in the UK, if anyone wants to learn more about politics through comedy, there's a comedian called Rosie Holt, who basically pretends to be an MP and people keep thinking she's an MP. There's Matt Green, who does lots of fake briefings. There's Larry and Paul, who also do stuff like that. And so people like that generate comedic content that is sort of like sometimes hyper realistic, because you think, oh, is that actually really a person? And it exposes something that helps you understand it, which is doesn't sound funny at all, but when you explain it, but it's very funny. So yeah, I think also our attention spans have changed a lot. And I'm currently working on like moving a lot of my stuff from online to offline and doing it in person. I like that in person became offline. I said that first because I'm so on the internet. But it is interesting, like, you know, there's been more reports of people talking about people at comedy shows having just worse behavior, like being on their phones, heckling more, joining in. And I think that's a post-pandemic thing of like not knowing where the line is, and also being on our phones all the time, and we're always in this private space, and the private and public space has sort of changed. I don't know. I don't think I've answered your question at all there, Greg.
No, I think these are good thoughts. I think the point about the pandemic is right. I think also the social media and the way that is during the pandemic, like everybody, you know, if somebody puts out a tweet or you put out something on TikTok or whatever, and you post it on Twitter, everybody with a Twitter account can go reply to it and say whatever the hell they want. I think, you know, now in the new post-pandemic offline live performance, maybe they feel they can continue to do that, even though they should just shut the fuck up, you know?
Yeah, because it's the line has been bled. You feel like you know this person, you follow them online, and you go like, well, I comment. So it's a strange one. And I think there's this big thing that people love talking about how you can't say anything these days, which people tend to do when they're hosting their £1 million Netflix specials. And I really don't think that's true. I think there are more consequences and stuff. But I think comedy is always evolving and getting better, and things are changing, and the use of tech and the use of like working with video and stuff, and that, you know, developing into the online, from the online world into real life. I think it's all really exciting and cool. And you're able to discover more comedians.
Yeah.
Like I've discovered a load of American comedians just by scrolling through TikTok and stuff and being like, whoa, they're so funny and inspiring. So I like it.
Yeah, you're right about it evolving. I feel like comedy, generally speaking, if you go back centuries, doesn't age as well as other art forms. Like there's an immediacy to it, or an urgency even, that makes it funny in the moment when it isn't quite as not to get dorky, but even the Shakespeare stuff. Like you go back and you're like, oh, people found this very funny. Like,
Okay,
it ain't totally funny now.
Well, it's like there's the bit. To get even more dorky, so there's a bit in Hamlet where Hamlet is giving his advice to the players,
Yeah.
So you're saying this is how you act, right? And to us, it's like, oh, that's Shakespeare telling people how to act. No, it's an in-joke that, because they all worked as a company of actors. So in that speech, he says, basically says, don't improvise too much and learn your lines. And that was a direct joke to the person who usually played the clown character that they were talking to, didn't learn their lines enough and always improvised. So that contextually would have been a joke for everyone to laugh at, and it's funny. And now we're so far gone that it's hard to then pass that, because you need so much contextual information to understand a joke. And it's like with my videos, you go back and watch some of my videos. Some of them stand alone, you understand them. Some of them, it's like, what is this in response to? Because you have to have the immediate... Some of my friends will watch my videos first and then Google the news story and then go, oh, I get it now.
Yeah. That's the way it goes. It's so when I encounter something that's really old and still funny, like I find Gilbert and Sullivan to me, like Pirates of Penzance, I think is the funniest thing ever. And it's still, it was written in 1865 or something, and it's still fucking really funny.
That was the first thing I think I remember seeing at the West Yorkshire Playhouse, which is now the Leeds Playhouse. I remember seeing that and being like, whoa, what if I could be one of them? Like, it was a real defining moment for me. So I agree with you about Pirates of Penzance. Yeah.
Were you ever in it? You could be the Pirate King. You'd be a good Pirate King, I think.
No, I've never been in it. But hear this, industry. Cast me as the Pirate King. Yeah, it's amazing.
I was the Major General in high school. I was, yeah.
Oh, can you give us a rendition? Give us a line or two.
You don't want that.
I think everyone wants
that. I'm a Major General. We have a mission to vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England. I quote that's historical. Marathon to Waterloo and not categorical. That's
beautiful. Beautiful.
I didn't warm up, you know. But
what's
great about the end of that is that they've captured all these pirates and they're all going to go to jail. And then they realize that they're actually noblemen. So they get and because they love the queen, they just set them all free because everything's fine.
Yeah.
So the theme there is, you know, there's two kinds of law. And if you're rich and powerful, you just can get away with being pirate.
Yeah. That is great. Like the Abbott and Costello who's on first sketch.
Yeah.
That will always be hilarious. Like the stuff, and then there'll be stuff that they do that is contextual that you have to know what was happening at the time.
Yeah. It's a lot depends on that. So now getting away from comedy, Succession. We should end with Succession.
Yeah.
Now we're not, by the time this runs, it will be, you know, 3 weeks or whatever it is in the future. So we've just watched the episode called Connor's Wedding. So anybody that isn't caught up and is going to be caught up, now's the time to stop because we might have spoilers. Yeah.
Turn this off.
Turn it off. But by the time this comes out, everybody really should have seen this. And if they haven't, they probably don't care. You did a wonderful TikTok that's the rap song to the Succession theme. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that episode because I'm watching it thinking, hey, this is going to be a fun one. It's Connor's wedding. It's going to be funny. I could kind of relax. And after about 10 minutes, I realize not only is this an important episode, this is one of those episodes that people are going to be talking about like forever.
Yeah.
So what was your thoughts on it?
Amazing. It's going to be a relatively boring thing to listen to because it's just going to be two guys going like, whoa, how cool is that? But they filmed some of it all the coverage. And then the big scene of, you know, when they're talking to Logan on the plane, they filmed that ongoing. They did the whole thing ongoing in a 27 minute long take and they film on film. So they had to keep replacing the film and they had cameras hidden around. So apparently as an actor, for the actors, it was a really, they basically did a short play doing it, which I think is like, it's just so brilliant, so brilliantly acted. I love that Logan dies off screen. I think that's such a brave choice.
Yeah.
I think it's so impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really good. And the acting, it's interesting about having it be a play, because I feel like all of the actors, all of them, without exception, were like totally on their A game.
Oh my God.
In that episode. Like there wasn't everybody rose to the occasion and got like, you know, they got really great performances out of everybody. I mean, they're always good, but.
But they were particularly exceptional. Also, I've wanted to, since we started the podcast, I've wanted to go, oh, hi, Greg. I should have started with that, to be fair, but we weren't on Succession at the beginning. He does a great American accent, right?
That was he
Matthew
does.
McFadden,
he
does. Yeah.
You sounded just like him. That was good.
That's my micro impression. It's all I can do. Yeah.
My wife and I do this thing where we debuted it just driving like home from dinner somewhere where, you know, it was like Kendall and Shiv, and I'm just like, is it okay? It's okay. Are you okay? Are we good? It's good. It's good. And then she would say the same thing. And we were laughing so hard. And then I recorded it to do on the thing, but the driving version was better than
that was brilliant. That was really good. I think my one issue with Succession is I'm not a huge fan of I mean it's complete macho bullshit and needs to die a fucking death of the method acting approach. I think it's so self-indulgent and so like it creates this meta narrative around a story. It's like, whoa. And I'm much more, you know, adhere to the Brian Cox school of acting, which is get the fucking job done sort of thing. And I saw a great tweet about this when Jeremy Strong talked about like how, you know, he's really into the character and like he channels all this stuff. And someone was like, as long as he's nice to the runners, I don't give a shit. Because I think that's a lot of the time that doesn't get spoken about on when we talk about things like Succession. Like the huge team that's behind making that happen, the camera operators, the gaffers, the sparks, like there are so many, the catering departments, so many people who have to do a top quality job. And then we're like, whoa, but he pretended he was the character the whole time. It's like, oh, who gives a shit? Was he in character when he was pooping? Was he? You don't know. But he does a great job. He's an incredible actor. The whole thing is amazing. But that, I just want that narrative to die, because you don't. There aren't, as far as I know, there aren't any female method actors. They just do the job.
Right, it is very me. Yeah. You know the Laurence Olivier story, right? Where I'm gonna tell it anyway, even if you know it, because people listening might not know. So
yeah.
When Dustin Hoffman was filming Marathon Man, they had to do a scene where he was supposed to be tired from running or something. So he like stayed up all night and he did all this sort of methody things. And he comes in and he does the scene, and Olivier is just like, why don't you try acting? It's easier.
Yeah, and like I'm not denying that it breeds results. Like people do a good job. But it's like, did we really give a shit that Leonardo DiCaprio actually ate a liver? Like, did that change our experience? Or did it just provide a newspaper headline? It's such bullshit. It's like, I always said this about, was it Daniel Day-Lewis who played Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah.
If he was in, right, if he's on set and there's a fire and the fire alarm goes off and everyone evacuates, he should die in the fire, because he wouldn't know what a fucking fire alarm was. Because where does the line end? When do you pick up your phone? It's just like, and I'm not trying to get rid of like the cosmic beauty of acting and art, but like you're doing a job. Do the job. Stop telling me about how good you are at your job.
Yeah, the results, you know, yeah. I
think someone might be bitter that he wasn't cast in Succession, Greg. That's what's happening here.
Oh my. So I'm excited to see how it's gonna wrap up. And I'm glad also that this is the last season. I'm glad they're not stretching it out. Too many shows do that where they stretch it out. There's two seasons too many, and it's annoying. Yeah. So I think they're probably gonna stick the landing, and this is gonna go down as one of the great, you know, one of the great series.
I mean, so brilliantly written. Like all the writers who work on that have just done such an exceptional job. And also keeping the secret that Logan died.
Yeah.
Very, because even Brian Cox was interviewed and they're like, how does it end well for your character? And he said something like, I think he gets everything he needs. Like, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. Super good. Super good. I'm excited for it. I'm excited. Is it good? It's good. It's good. wait, do the Tom voice again. I like the Tom voice.
Oh, hi, Greg. I lost it. Shiv? I think. It's very hard to do it for more than a second.
That's good. It's really good. Very, very well done. You should be an actor. Okay, so where can we find you? Your Twitter handle is, what is your Twitter handle?
At WSEBAG, WCBAG.
Okay.
I was like, oh, it's so cool. It's not taken. WC bag. And then I was like, that is an awful sound. WC bag. No. But it's short. You know, it's
And your TikTok is the same? It's the same thing?
I think so, yeah, yeah. I'm bigger on Twitter. But, you know, you could change that, listeners. You could shift the balance. Yeah, I'm at WCBag. You can follow me and that'd be great. I've got legitimate likes. There's a podcast. I also have a sketch comedy group called Just These Please. We do, like, non-satirical sketch comedy. And, yeah, it's great. Say hi. Why not?
Yeah, yeah. It's good. Thank you so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun to talk to you, and have fun at the coronation, you know?
Oh, yeah, I will do. I'll be there on the front lines, you know? I definitely will be with my marmalade sandwiches. Did you hear about that when the Queen died with the marmalade sandwiches?
No.
This might be a tangent that doesn't make it in, but the Queen did a little short, like, skit with Paddington Bear. And so basically when the Queen died, people were leaving flowers and tributes. The royal family had to put out a statement saying, thank you so much for all the tributes. Please stop leaving marmalade sandwiches. Because, like, you know, birds were eating them. Also, cost of living crisis. Like, don't just waste food. But it was absolutely insane that people were like, the idea that someone was home and saw the Queen died and thought, I know what I have to do. And made a sandwich for a dead queen, took it into London, queued up for a while, and placed it on the sidewalk.
We all grieve in different ways, I suppose. You know,
that's actually an English tradition. We always, if you ever have an English friend die, always bring a marmalade sandwich.
Yeah,
it's very rude not to.
Oh, God. Will Seabag, Montefiore, thank you so much for joining me. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. It was an absolute pleasure.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.